Our second panelist is Dr. Eileen Gardner. She also earned her doctorate in education from Harvard University, having studied earlier at Penn State and the University of Wisconsin. She has taught English and reading at the high school level. She has also taught younger children with learning disabilities and emotional problems. She spent a year as research assistant to Dr. Robert Selman in a social reasoning project at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and served 2 years in research at Harvard Center for Moral Development and Moral Education, working with its founder, the eminent Dr. Lawrence Kohlberg. The Heritage Foundation lured her to Washington, where she is laboring to clean up some stalls in the Augean stables as the foundation's educational policy analysis. Her topic is moral education. Dr. Gardner.
Thank you. Any educational program must stand on a system of unequivocal values. To speak of an educational program without values is a contradiction in terms, since values, even when not explicitly stated, are implicit in every action, in every choice. The questions which must be answered before one attempts to discuss education are, what is the end point of human development? Towards what end are we educating children? And correlatively, what is the purpose of man's existence? The nation's present educational dilemma rests on the schism in the way people see these issues. Education must both serve and lead to some end. Unfortunately, this end is no longer a matter of general agreement. Many believe that the end is defined or set by man, that agreement or consensus determines what is right and good. If this be true, it is only to be expected that the right and the good will vary from time to time and from place to place. Others acknowledge their part in and dependence upon a higher power and ultimate standards. They feel that the purpose of education is to prepare the individual to strive to embody these highest standards. The teacher who believes that man determines his own ends and that truth is arrived at by consensus tends to a shallow and shifting commitment to the classroom. Television, radio, newspapers often adequately meet this teacher's need for information. In these media, all of the thinking and interpretation are done first. Distortions and manipulations to meet the needs in the marketplace are the rule. The teacher who relies primarily on this source accepts and teaches as truth much that is false. Those teachers who insist that they are value neutral are in actuality teaching a most emphatic value, that any idea or point of view is as good as any other. Such value neutrality gives rise to a disorder in which the insignificant, even the damaging, can assume equality with or even ascendancy over that which experience has shown to be proper educational fare. It is the rare teacher who has given allegiance to a power higher than man and who has informed himself enough and thought enough about man's collective experience to have a point of view that has touched the wellspring of the human condition. From this wellspring, such teachers draw direction and nourishment and set the tone and the content of their educational programs. They teach from a point of view that enables them to awaken the highest potential in their students. Unfortunately, by law, discussion of a higher power is not even permitted in the classroom. Since what is no longer spoken of disappears from the social rubric, a breed of people is being produced who have never been exposed to, are unaware of, and do not value the truths and ideals upon which this nation was built and upon which mankind's well-being depends. The results of having bred such children are all too evident. We are now looking at problem students, students who are strangely amoral in their outlook and behavior, students who have developed a taste for what traditionally has been considered highly improper for youth or for anyone, and who are highly resistant to change. For example, The homicide rate of young white males was the highest on record in 1979. It was 311% higher than the previous low in 1955 and 50% higher than the previous high in 1931. In 1981, 43.7% of those arrested for murder or non-negligent manslaughter were under 25. The arrest rates of males, females, whites, and blacks between the ages of 18 and 24 increased 1,850% between 1933 and 1980. The rates for those under 18 increased an even more astounding 9,300% during that same period of time. The suicide rate for young white males, ages 15 to 19, reached the highest on record in 1977 and has declined only slightly since then. And the rate of out-of-wedlock births of white adolescent females is at its highest point since 1940. Since that time, this rate has increased an incredible 800%. The severity of classroom discipline problems has been documented recently by the Cabinet Council Working Group on School Violence and Discipline. According to that report, in 1978, each month, 282,000 students were physically attacked in America's secondary schools. Each month, 125,000 teachers were threatened with physical harm. In 1983, 50% of a large sample of Boston teachers responding to a survey reported having been victims of robbery, assault, or larceny during the previous school year. General indiscipline in the form of insolence, disobedience, and the refusal of students to apply themselves to academic tasks is rampant. Most disturbing, students don't seem to know why they're here or where they're going, and their behavior seems to betray a certain desperation. The much-discussed decline in SAT scores pales in comparison to the moral and spiritual decay that has taken hold of our youth and fostered destructive attitudes and behaviors. Indeed, borrowing a metaphor from Socrates, American youth have been grazing on a pasturage of poisonous herbs. Primary attention needs to be paid to the restoration of a moral order to our educational system. I suggest that that system ought to be based upon the following. One, the end point of human development is to grow eternally closer to God. Two, the purpose of man's existence is to exercise his God-given free will to choose good over evil, and thereby optimally to serve universal welfare, his country's, his family's, and his own. Specifically, man belongs to a whole greater than himself. This whole has its genesis in the divine. All good within man comes from this source. To the extent that man aligns himself with this divine within him, is he involved in truth and goodness? To the extent that man regards himself as the cause and the end point of his being, is he involved in falsity and ultimately evil? The larger whole contains within itself an order, which is evident on the physical plane through the waxing and waning of the moon, for example, the rise and the fall of the tides, the seasons. This evident order of the physical plane is informed by a not so evident order of higher or more interior planes of existence, including the mental and the spiritual planes. Each more interior plane responds to more refined vibrations. Each interior plane interpenetrates and thereby informs the one exterior to it. For example, man's rationality is germane to the physical plane. The interior planes respond to the finer vibrations of intuition. Rationality is, therefore, informed by intuition. Man has an individual order which corresponds to that of the universe. His body corresponds to the material, or most exterior plane. His mind corresponds to the mental. His spirit corresponds to the spiritual, or most interior plane. Man's purpose is to place himself in harmony with this universal order, to give priority to the highest part of himself, his spiritual nature. Then the lower parts, the appetites and even rationality, are brought into the divine design by an inflow from above. The divine consecrates and purifies the lower. Disorder occurs when the higher element is held in check by the tyranny of the low. When this happens, chaos, absurdity, and ultimately evil reign. Examples of this can be readily found in modern Western society. Man can properly direct his life through apprehending and giving actuality to immutable laws of the universe, to the extent that man's moral order comes into harmony with universal immutable laws, does society ensure the conditions which allow man to develop. Historical tradition and cultural intuition at their finest reflect the divine mind behind them. They are not, in and of themselves, the origin of truth. Some of these laws which can be known on this plane of existence are the law of mentalism, of cause and effect, of attraction, and of compensation. The law of mentalism states that an individual's external environment is a reflection of his inner mental state. Each of us is responsible for his life situation, which is an inevitable result of choices he has made. The laws of cause and effect and of attraction state, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. What you are within will attract like people, circumstances, and environments without. The law of compensation states that development occurs only through the individual's own efforts. If one makes no effort, he makes no real gain. It is an impossibility to confer from without that which must be built from within. Because there are immutable laws or objective standards of the good, moral learning can be measured by one's growing understanding of and alignment with these standards. Right action will then follow automatically. Pain becomes the vehicle for inner correction and realignment. How are teachers to help children find the God self within, to align themselves with the universal moral order, to sense the meaning and the deep sense of purpose to their and to every man's life? First, teachers must be moral beings themselves. That is, they must be people accustomed to adjusting their conduct to principles, people who have acknowledged their part in and dependence upon a higher power and ultimate standards, and who feel that the purpose of education is to prepare their students to strive to embody these highest standards. Specifically, children must be told that they are a part of a larger whole, which is given direction and meaning by God, and that it is their responsibility and their purpose to align their will with God's. Teachers should read and assign to children books that emphasize right and wrong, objective truths, and a higher power. C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia and Rudyard Kipling's The First Jungle Book are excellent. The Chronicles of Narnia emphasize a higher being, immutable laws, and good and evil. The First Jungle Book beautifully illustrates natural law, which is based on universal law, and the distinction between right and wrong. For older students, Swedenborg's Heaven and Hell, Conjugal Love, and Plato's Republic, which focuses on order, are suggested. Textbooks, too, should emphasize eternal truths, virtue, and wisdom. Although it is in short supply, more and more good material is being produced. The McGuffey readers are now generally available again. High vibrations should permeate a classroom. Any classroom and teacher must give priority to and foster the noblest and best in its students. The room should be kept neat, clean, cheerful. Low vibratory behavior should not be enforced. Graffiti should be erased without comment, for example, the day it is written. Quotations and poems that reflect upon high and positive ways to approach life should be used daily in some way, through handwriting lessons, memorization assignments, or for general discussion. Some of my favorites are the poem If by Rudyard Kipling and the following quotations. Right and wrong exist in the nature of things. Things are not right because they are commanded, nor wrong because they are prohibited. Robert Greene Ingersoll. Nobody ever finds life worth living. One always has to make it worth living. All the people to whom life has been abundantly worth living have made it so by an interior, creative, spiritual contribution of their own. Harry Emerson Fosdick. Happiness does not spring from physical or mental pleasure, but from the development of reason and the adjustment of conduct to principles. Not only should teachers talk to children about universal principles, they should apply those principles to everyday classroom interaction. Growth takes place through experience and through thinking about experience. Two activities which can actively and effectively promote positive group growth are group sports as experience and class meetings as thinking about that experience. Order should be stressed in any classroom. The teacher, as the adult, should exercise strong and clear authority. A class should never be held back for a student or group of students who clearly function below them. Priority should go to those students who are prepared to do right and to go forward. The laws of mentalism and cause and effect emphasize responsibility. In addition to holding students responsible for their everyday interactions and schoolwork assignments, fair rules should be devised by the group, if at all possible, posted for all to see, and enforced consistently and impartially by the teacher. In summary, the ultimate function of education is to make man all that he is capable of being. To attain this end, an educational program must provide the finest leadership, give priority to the noblest and best in its students, and profess and pursue the highest of values, love of God, of goodness, of truth, of serving universal welfare in those it seeks to serve.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gardner. I've just discovered some dimensions of Harvard I had not suspected.